KaiserNetwork.org.
Don Cheadle, actor and activist. John Prendergast, senior advisor of the International Crisis Group. And Jeffrey Schwartz, president and CEO of the Timberland Company, please step to the stage at this time. We will begin right away, ladies and gentlemen. Please hold your seats. Our workshop continues immediately. Please take your seats for our final workshop session.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, can we have your attention? The next panel is here. It's on another subject of critical importance, and we have a group of people who each has direct personal experience and who has done a lot to deal with the issues there. I'm not going to take the time to introduce them because you all know who they are, and they will, in the course of their discussion, make clear why they've been asked to be here. I'm going to launch right into it and begin by asking you, Don. Millions of words have been written and spoken. Thousands of speeches have been given. And yet, nothing seems to happen other than a continuing tragedy. What are you doing about it, and what can the people in this room do about it?
Well, I am by no means an expert on the subject. I consider myself a witness. I traveled to the region, heard stories from the refugees, witnessed with my own eyes their plight and the conditions that they're living under. And I was sort of pulled into this situation. It wasn't by plan. After the film Hotel Rwanda was released, I was contacted by Ed Royce, congressman out of California, Orange County. And he said, there's something going on in this part of the world, Darfur. I don't know if you're aware of it. I wasn't very aware of it. I had cursory knowledge of it. And he said, "This is your film. Sort of speaks to the same issues that we're seeing in Darfur. And would you join us on this congressional delegation?" And we were able to tour the region and actually cross into Darfur. John was with us as well, and see what was happening. And I've then sort of people have found me. I have a website, and I'd say every third letter that I get, someone is asking this question that's at the bottom of this pad of paper, what can I do? And I would point them to different NGOs. I would point them to different organizations that I knew were working in the area. But I was frustrated too. Recently I've just, the main thing that I think that I can do is while people turn cameras on me and put a mic in front of me is to ask, continually ask the same question that you asked me. Why are we still sitting here wringing our hands about a situation that is, this? It's not Rwanda where people found out later and said, oh my God, I had no idea. This is ongoing, it's escalating, it's happening as we're sitting in this room right now. And what will it take? What is the involvement that it's going to take to stem the tide of this, what could potentially be a genocide in the making? And I think that we have to attack it on all levels. Something that you said at the end of the last panel is very important about how we have to deal with this economically, because we know that altruism is very rarely the thing that gets people to move. There has to be a component that they feel that they are affected by. And it's usually in the pocketbook, unfortunately, but it's true. We are signing, not we are, there was a bill that was co-authored by several people in California for the UC Regents, the schools, to divest their funds from student, from governments that are, or from companies that are investing in Sudanese companies, and also statewide. And we sort of have been pushing this bill for the past 6 or 7 months, and we believe it's going to be signed into law very soon by the governor. So it's these kinds of efforts that I think we have to continue to do while we're still watching this occur that can have some effect, because clearly saying this is happening and it will not stand and never again and it's an affront to humanity, they do seem to be phrases that we've heard before but are really not proving to be effective. So I think we have to move beyond oh my God and start moving into direct financial punitive measures.
Jeffrey.
Thank you for the privilege of participating. I would say most of what Don said is right, it was, but not complete, because he said he's a witness. I would say he's a witness and a champion, because it's one thing to see, it's another thing to be able to say or to sing or to show, because and that is one thing that everybody in this audience and any audience can do. They can have the moral courage to look at what needs to be seen, and they can respond to it however they did, as you did. And then they can do what they can do. They can sing, or they can draw a picture, or they can create a coalition, or they can, and they can compel others to be part of the process of creating a sustainable social change, not a campaign, but sustainable social change. And that's what you did for me. I'm a CEO of a publicly traded company. I don't have customers in Darfur. I don't have any business at all in Darfur. There's nothing I can do in Darfur that makes my shareholders a dollar, per se. But your bearing witness and your eloquence relative to the point, your passion about the point, compels me to confront the illogical, right? At Timberland, it makes sense for us to worry about the environment because we're an outdoor company. It makes sense for us to worry about France because we have business in France, but we got no customers in Darfur, and we got no business in Darfur. And so the shareholders say, what are you doing with Darfur? But I think the framing point was the right framing point. Okay, so let's agree. It's not an activist's job to be involved in Darfur, and it's sure not a boot salesman's job to be involved in Darfur. So that's fine. But actually isn't fine, right? Because if you aren't going to witness and champion, and you aren't going to make me use the economic power at Timberland to connect to consumers, we have 30 million consumers in the United States, and you said, sell them a boot, how about sell them a boot and tell them a story? And I thought to myself, I wouldn't have thought about rape and genocide being the first story I want to tell my boot consumer. But you said sometimes you choose and sometimes you're chosen. And so I thought to myself, that's pretty compelling. And I thought to myself, I still don't want to do that. I still don't want that. It's hard to make the logical case, right, Senator? And then John said something which was pretty powerful to hear, which is, okay, so you can choose two titles in this conversation. You can choose illogically involved CEO, that's one title, or you can choose the title missing in action, well, people died. And I thought, you got to call me one name or the other. I'll be marked as illogical, right? Right? And then we sat together and we thought about how can we build a compelling effort thoughtfully and strategically to engage people. Not the obligatory picture of suffering, not the wristband and a rhetorical flourish, but a sustainable change. Because you argued from the beginning, this isn't a gestural solution. This requires a different time frame of thinking. This requires a different strategy for solution. And I think the private sector has something to do there. I think the private sector generically is good at creating strategic solutions to complex problems. We put the pressure of a marketplace to work. Think about it. It wasn't that long ago you put a letter in a mailbox and it would get there when it got there. But then somebody figured out absolutely positively overnight was a better business idea. And so all of a sudden it's absolutely positively overnight. That's a strategic solution to an interesting challenge. We can absolutely, if we can figure out the way to collaborate across the really sharp but artificial lines of civic society, we can create solutions in Darfur. And it's not an intellectually interesting notion. It isn't. It's a visceral notion. That's what you witnessed, that's what you champion, and that's why you can count me on your side.
Thank you, Jeff.
John, in addition to that question, you follow this issue very well. Over and over again, people ask themselves and others, how can this be happening? How can it be that everyone seems to agree there's a terrible problem, it has to be addressed, but nothing real to deal with it seems to occur? Put it in context for us.
Well, I think in addition to having witnesses, champions, and chosen boot salesmen, we're bell ringers. I think we're the sort of bell ringing anti-hypocrisy brigade, because part of what we've got is that there's a situation in which people have generally across the globe agreed that the situation, the crisis in Darfur is perhaps the worst in the world. People disagree on labels. Some people say genocide. Some people say massive crimes against humanity, mass atrocities, whatever label you want to put on it. It is, quite frankly, with Congo, a very close competitor, the worst humanitarian and human rights disaster on the face of the earth today. And with the summoning of the Genocide Convention by President Bush in 2004 and Secretary of State Colin Powell in his speech to the Senate, we thought, many around the country and perhaps many sympathetic ears around the world believed that the invocation of that sacred covenant would draw a whole set of actions out of led by the U.S., of the international community, consonant with the phrase never again, which of course every politician uses with regularity and around these issues. And I think that part of what has happened is that as the world has come, particularly in this country, we come up against barriers, indifference, inertia, the usual sort of policy, other priorities. We have a very solid, strong counterterrorism relationship, the United States does, with the government of Sudan, which prevents us from blasting away in the ways that we need to when a country commits the kind of atrocities that it is committing now today. So there are fairly significant obstacles, and the only way that you're going to overcome those kinds of obstacles in a situation like this, because our normal temperature, our normal sort of posture with respect to the Congos and the Ugandas and the Sudans of the world is, you know, that it's a flat line. There isn't a policy response to these things. You have to raise the temperature through citizen action if there's going to be any kind of a response. So we've risen the temperature. There are groups all over this country and now increasingly in other countries, principally rooted in Christian communities and Jewish communities and in student groups, that are pressing and pushing for a more robust response. So they've driven the temperature up from sort of the normal 98 degrees to about 100. And that's gotten some things. I mean, we've got a little bit of movement, a little interest on the part of the administration, but we got to drive it up to 101. Otherwise, we're not going to make a difference. And I think we're there now. Is the question? On the one hand, you've got the structural inertia of the system, which usually does not respond to mass atrocities while they're occurring. On the one hand, and on the other hand, this ragtag band of citizen groups all over the United States, and again, increasingly around the world, who are saying, "No, we've got to make never again mean something." So the battle is on, and the fate of millions of people, not just in Darfur, but in Congo, Uganda, and Somalia, and Liberia, if things don't work out as we all hope they do, will. And we've got to build that movement to address these things.
But, John, what is the immediate specific issue? You say drive the temperature up to get who to do what?
It's we often diverted by difficult policy choices. In 2004, it was a question of whether, during the presidential campaign, whether or not President Bush would call it genocide. That was John Kerry's constant call. Mr. President, will you call it genocide? Diversion of energy. We have a new diversion of energy, sadly, today, and that is whether we go from our current posture of doing very little to nothing or militarily invading the country with the nice phrase, non-consensual deployment of force. There are hundreds of policy tools that we have in the middle between doing nothing and invading a country that can address crimes against humanity, that can address the commission of mass atrocities. There are the targeted sanctions that the United Nations has already authorized but hasn't imposed. There are more general economic sanctions, oil embargoes, and other kinds of things that the United Nations Security Council has authorized but hasn't yet imposed. There are specific sanctions you can undertake against companies that the regime, now that it's invested in the oil sector so heavily, have established all throughout Sudan, that are doing business all throughout Europe and the Middle East, could sanction them, could freeze their assets. The United Nations Security Council has authorized these things but hasn't imposed. The Sudan government, quite naturally, it would be irrational for it to do anything else but to continue with its counterinsurgency strategy, which happens to chew up thousands of lives per month. And until there's a cost for their actions, they won't change their behavior. We have a track record in the 90s when a cost was imposed. President Clinton led the effort in the 90s to impose sanctions on Khartoum for its role in support for international terrorism. It changed its behavior because it didn't want the scarlet letter on its shirt. And so we have a track record, things we could do if we had the political will to do it, but it's blocked because of our "you're either with us or against us" mentality on counterterrorism, and the Khartoum regime has been smart enough to be giving us information. Of course, they hosted bin Laden for 6 years during the 90s, so they have information to give, and we've basically traded off the counterterrorism agenda for robust response to the atrocities there. So what do we need to do? We need to impose a cost, a specific cost, for the actions this government's taking, the officials that are actually orchestrating the counterinsurgency that has killed so many people and rendered homeless millions. And when we impose that cost, we will see a change immediately on the ground in Darfur.
Jeffrey, you mentioned earlier the process by which you went through to involve your company in the process. What has been the reaction? Positive, negative, both? Tell us a little bit about it, and then particularly comment on John's suggestion that action be taken against companies who are actively involved in efforts that at least indirectly support the regime there.
Well, my kids are supporters, so I did carry that constituency, Senator. My shareholders are, they hold me blameless as long as the results are good, because it's clear from the disjunction, the lack of Venn diagram overlap between social justice, the pursuit of justice for the victims of Darfur, and the building of our brand. There's not only not an obvious conclusion, it's an intellectually difficult point to make. And so in the context of stakeholders, the 6,000 men and women at Timberland think it's a spectacular thing to learn about how to raise your voice in a constructive way to be part of a systematic solution, as opposed to the cause du jour. That's a powerful thing that I think informs our culture and makes us a more able enterprise, as a funny derivative point. We tried very hard to take Don, among his various talents, is a graphic artist of some repute. So he designed a Timberland boot with a very beautiful boot, and we made 100 pairs, hundreds of small number for a company our size, of really special ones, with the intention of giving them to influencers. And we worked out the sales strategy. It was really cool, because if you're giving something away, it shouldn't be hard to do, right? But we were going to go to, he knows famous people, so we were going to go, let's say he was going to go to these famous people and give them a pair of boots in their size. It's a really cool thing. And so people take, yeah, sure, I'll take that. But then the trick is you don't give it, you hold on. So now they grab, and you grab as this awkward thing, and you lean forward in the middle, and Don's holding on. They're kind of like, give me my boots. No, well, if you take the boot, you take the obligation that comes with the boot, right? It's a form of emotional and moral contract. Be part of the solution. And we made 100 pairs, and we gave them all away. I don't know if we built 100 champions the way we should have. It was a neat idea with some success. We did put T-shirts together at Don's direction, and we sold some. We put them in Timberland stores all around the world, and we tried to have a conversation with consumers. We got tons of media impressions against consumers trading on Don's celebrity and whatever power of the brand we had to offer, because those are things, I think, from a business perspective, I felt very confident. We put it out there. It's not clear what would come back. It's not a linear thing. How are people influenced emotionally? What do they do? What's the knock-on effect of encountering in a nice suburban mall somewhere in Westchester the rape and genocide in Darfur, which maybe I'm not supposed to call it, but that's what I think it is, but you're the expert. Well, the bad things in Darfur. We spend time debating what to call it, so that's okay. We called it bad, and we put a T-shirt out there, and it sounds banal, but that's what we do. We make products, and we try to have a conversation with consumers about them. But if you say, did we sell 100 million T-shirts, and like the Lance Armstrong yellow bracelet, which is an incredibly brilliant gesture by our competitors, Nike, that raised millions of dollars for cancer. And I thought, well, why didn't we sell 100 million T-shirts? I think I missed a step. I know I missed a step in thinking about the complexity and the depth of emotion that this issue evokes, because it's not you give them, the line from the Sun Also Rises, Ernest Hemingway, you give them $5 and they give you a stuffed dog. It's a nice, simple transaction. Everything's okay. There's no such thing as a simple transaction that solves this. And our consumer model is we'll try and design a beautiful tie. We'll sell it for whatever price we can get for it, and see you later, goodbye. That's unfortunately not the simple solution that's available to us. And so the consumer response was puzzlement. Why are you doing this? I don't want to hear about this in the Westchester Mall. I got a mortgage to make, or else I want to know what the newest fashion is, and you want to talk about Darfur. And we learned a lot from that. We learned a lot about how to present a complex issue to a consumer. We didn't learn that you don't do this. We did learn that you have to be thoughtful about how to do this. And I would say that's an ongoing lesson. To recap, the stakeholders at Timberland, the men and women who work at the place are purposeful people. And so they found this is very constant, the notion of purpose. Our shareholders view is knock yourself out, better make the quarter. Our consumer said, we'll need to talk about this some more. And so we keep meeting and figuring out what to do next. That's maybe articulate, but it's honest.
Don, of the wide range of options for action, some of which John mentioned, you've become passionately involved in this now. What do you think are the most important first steps that have to be taken?
Well, I think we have to continue to build a groundswell of information. Each one has to teach one. And we have to continue to share what we know and what we have seen, and to make people aware. But it's remarkable that it's not remarkable. It's very underreported, and it doesn't appear on the front pages of newspapers or in the headlines in the news. So we have to continue to keep this issue in the forefront in whatever way we can. Coming to the Clinton Global Initiative, speaking at premieres, that's what I can do is my job, because I do find that the more people know. We had this rally at UCLA to try and to get this bill that I'm speaking about, this UC Regents bill, sponsored. And when I first showed up, there were about six people at the press conference, and I thought, oh, well, this is very fitting. You know, there should be only six people here. This is how this issue has been dealt with. But as we walked through the campus, and each and every individual that was in this with us, that was with the group Stand, and what's the UCLA group? It's not Stand. It's
Darfur Action Committee.
Yeah, Darfur Action Committee. As they would speak to each student and they would tell them what we were doing, we started to collect more people. And by the time we finally got to the meeting, there were over 100 people in the office of the UC Regents to stand holding pictures and locked arms to say we're with this. And that was a very impactful moment. I think it's what helped to get the decision made in the meeting to push the bill forward. And had we showed up with our five people, it may not have been the same sort of response. So that was a very good demonstration to me that you can be effective, but you have to continue to keep your foot on the pedal and push this forward, and that we do see that our leaders respond to what they believe their constituency wants. And if they don't see that kind of that sort of care and that sort of concern, then obviously it'll be business as usual, and they'll go on to serve the gods that they have to serve in order to keep their position. So we have to say that this matters to us. It is important to us. We do not want to go down in history as being the generation that was a part of an ongoing genocide, or whatever you want to call it, counterinsurgency that caused 2 million people displaced and hundreds of thousands of lives lost while it was going on, and said, wow, I don't know what to do. Do something. Do something. I don't know what to do is not the valid response. It's I'm going to do whatever I can. And you never know what it's going to be that's going to rally people around you. But there will be no rally if you do not make a step.
Just briefly, one of the most important points in persuading people to do something is to appeal to their self-interest in some form. You said you got into this by accident. What are your feelings of self-satisfaction, or do you feel you're getting something out of this?
I'm very frustrated is what I'm feeling, because we're still sitting here talking about something that is happening on a scale that is unimaginable to me. And when I did the film, a lot of the extras in Hotel Rwanda were actually had been victims of the massacre, and they would come up to me and show me their scars and tell me their stories, and I would say, I'm just an actor, you know. I what can I do? How can I be your champion? How can I help you? And they said, tell our story. Tell our story. Just tell our story and continue to tell our story so that this will not happen to other generations down the line. And I said, well, that I will do, and that I will continue to do. But obviously, when you feel like you're doing that and you don't see the line moving, it's very frustrating. But I would say that incrementally, I do see changes happening. I do see that what I see is that there's been a coalition, that many coalitions are locking arms together. It used to be very disparate people do, you know, very disparate actions and sort of all raindrop throughout the country that I was aware of. But now that I've sort of gone around to a lot of them, I'm seeing that we're reaching toward each other saying, well, we need to get together. That's one of the reasons I had spoke with Jeffrey, and John and I had a sort of a summit of people. Nick Kristof is a part of it, Samantha Power, Gail Smith, Senator Biden came in. We were able to say we're all saying these same things out there in the world, but we need to get together and say them and sort of try to drive a wedge into this argument. And that's what I think it's going to take, is people continuing to reach toward each other saying we're frustrated too. Let's rely on each other and try and form a larger coalition to push this forward and turn up the temperature.
Thank you very much. As you know, and as the members of the audience know, we've now come to the point where there will be discussions at each table. Those will be for 30 minutes. Then we will resume. There will be questions that will be received from the audience, a summary by Rob Malley, and then some concluding comments by each of you.
Just a word. This is the last time you're going to do this, so do it well. It's the last time, but in a way it's the most obvious one, because the question that you should all ask yourselves is, what can I do? And to quote Don, I don't know is not a valid answer. So you got 23 minutes to think of what you can do and what you suggest others do, and then we'll come back. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You've sent up to us a very impressive and wide-ranging number of questions. Again, time will not permit the asking of but just a few of them. One that several asked, and I'll read one representative question, and I'll direct it to you, John. There are many in the audience who might benefit from a quick background of this conflict. Can we get one? Who are the players? What interests are at stake, et cetera? Can you do that in a few minutes?
How many minutes?
Take 5 minutes, John.
Okay, I'm watching that clock. 2003, there was a great, in Darfur, as in all of the regions in the periphery of Sudan, there's a feeling of alienation, of marginalization. They're cut out of the power and wealth of the country, as in so many countries around the world. Up till 2003, that opposition, that disagreement with those policies was expressed politically. They finally decided, a number of the groups in Darfur, to take up arms against the government and join in a wider rebellion against the government, with allying themselves with southerners, with people from the center and people from the east. The war quickly, the battles quickly turned favorable to the rebels. They won 23 engagements in a row. The first 23 battles between the government and the rebels were won by the rebels, and the government of Sudan decided, we're not going to take any chances with this. And they unleashed the hounds of hell. All of you have heard of the Janjaweed, the militias that basically the Sudan's version, Darfur's version of the KKK, a much more horrific version, violent version of the KKK. And they gave them arms and money and impunity, most importantly impunity, to do whatever they wanted to do to cleanse Darfur of non-Arab populations that were opposed to the government. So for the last 3.5 years, this, as we call it, counterinsurgency, genocidal counterinsurgency campaign, others call it mass atrocities, again, that the language is irrelevant, it's what it is, the horrific crimes are being committed in Darfur. The policy debates are very stark now, you know, whether we intervene militarily or not, whether we, as we discussed in the first chapter of this session, whether we impose a cost, accountability for the actions, for the crimes that are being committed on those that are orchestrating them. And these are the decisions, and no, these are the questions, and there are no decisions made by the United Nations Security Council. The United States has not led enough, robustly enough, to make to move that body to action. We're left with wonderful resolutions that certainly, if they were followed, the horrors in Darfur would have been ended a long time ago.
What were the particular grievances of the rebels? You said they were cut out of power, but the conflict was initiated. There must have been more specific motivations and objectives of the rebels. And then secondly, is there a single controlling rebel leadership or entity, or are there different factions, as so often happens and complicates conflict situations?
Yeah. In 1989, the current government in Sudan, the current regime, took power in a military coup, basically slowly and steadily expropriated all decision-making powers, regional powers, national powers, in the hands of a small group, small clique of officials of the National Islamic Front Party. They set up these companies that I described earlier that have basically expropriated the entire economy. And we've seen the Sudan go from a very poor country to a mid-level oil producer over the last 6 or 7 years. So immediate wealth. Most of these guys have their hands and arms and bodies in the cookie jar. The biggest issue in Sudan today is not the war in Darfur or the war in southern Sudan. It's corruption. So this is, you know, this is the context that, and I think that these the political opposition in Darfur saw a very unfair system. They saw negotiations between the north and south proceeding. They were cut out of those negotiations. That the lesson they learned was, we got to shoot our way into that pie cutting ceremony so we get some. Today, a question about whether the rebels are united. This is, of course,
One of the tragedies of many in Darfur is that the government has pursued a policy, as do so many dictatorships, in war context of divide and conquer. And we could even say in the Darfurian context, divide and destroy, because they've gone systematically after weak links in the rebellion, offered huge amounts of money to some of these people. They've splintered off and created factions, which then fight against the rebels. And mostly, it's not fighting between the government and the rebels. It's fighting against the civilian supporters. That's what makes these wars, so many of these wars in Africa, so deadly, is that governments and rebel groups don't fight against each other. They go straight for the civilians. They go straight up to the women and children, and they burn villages. And we know all the stories that have come out of Darfur, some of the most horrific tales we've seen in the last half century. So right now, the divisions and the rebellion is one of the main problems we have in trying to get political progress. Because ultimately, if I can just throw one last thing in there, is the way this horror is going to end in Darfur is through a political solution. We can throw a few thousand more peacekeepers in, whether they're UN or AU. This is not going to stop the crisis. It's going to have to be a political solution. That's why pressure on the government of Sudan through imposing a cost on what it's doing, and then it makes the calculation it's got to stop the killing.
Jeffrey and Don, several people asked about making it personal, that something that people can relate to is critical to getting engagement and activism across the country. So I think you're at a couple of the tables, but right now, if you spoke individually to each person in this room, what is it, Jeffrey, I'll start with you, that you would ask them to do on a personal level? One person doing one thing, what is it?
I desperately wish I could say that the one thing that everybody should do is boycott this one company because that'll change the thing, or you should write a postcard to this address. But I have to say humbly, I don't have a one thing. I think the notion of committing to the conversation, which is an amorphous statement, is not, but it's not an ephemeral statement. It's a hugely important one. I don't believe sustainable social change is going to come out of a single point strategy. It's too complex a conversation. And so I think we first simply said we have to have a strategy that's about sustainable change. It's not about peacekeepers, not a strategy. It's a tactic in the context of a strategy. And I can't do anything about peacekeepers. Maybe you can. And so if that's what you can do, peacekeepers, then that's what you should do. But we have to have a strategy that says this is what must be done, and then we're going to need to think about who can do what. Now, Don maybe can do two things. He can design boots and be famous. I can barely do one thing. But if I do my one thing with competence in the context of strategy, right, whether it's building capability for the activists or whether it's a consumer engagement model that has to do with boots and shoes and clothes, each has got to do what he must or she must do. The problem is there isn't a strategy. There's a tremendous amount of passion. There's a tremendous amount of energy, but it's diffused because it's not strategic. And so the net is people are making huge gestures, postcards and passion and rallies and conversations. And Don, you're right, it's better knit together than it was. But if I told you this before, if I was trying to sell this business plan to my board of directors, they'd say, sober up and try again. I mean, you've got to bring us back a comprehensive view of what has to be done. And then task me. But we get task-focused, not strategy-focused, and the net is we end up frustrated.
Well, I think to piggyback on what Jeffrey said is that there are many people who are emotionally connected to this and are moved to do something and are reaching out to try and find what that solution is. And one of the mechanisms that through our meeting that we have that I think is important to focus on is a way to collate all of these sort of efforts and design a unified sort of a message. I'm going to read these people's names who gave me their cards, and if you don't want me to say your name, just wave your hand and say shut up. But Ross B. Glickman came up to me with Urban Retail Properties and said, we have 15,000 retail stores across the world. This is a great opportunity. I don't know what I can do. Let me work with you and figure something out. Kevin Clausen, the president of Reach the Children, gave me a card. Jean Borgol with the Internews Network. All of these people are saying the same things to me. And these are the opportunities that we have when people are saying, what can I do? I have this great resource, to talk to one another and say, what do you have? What is your tool? What is your gift? What can you do? Or you're a member of a church group that has a certain amount of influence over your community. Oh, you run a system of schools that you can make this a part of your program as far as what you teach. We don't know what your individual skill set is, but whatever that is, you can go to my website. We're going to roll out, hopefully, very soon, a campaign that was a result of the efforts that we made a few months ago in this meeting that we had. And one of the components of that will be to try and bring together all of these people that want to do something, that are looking for something to do. And we have to ask that question to you as you ask it of us. What do you have? And then help us figure out a way to utilize that together. And then we can be more effective.
Rob?
Thank you. Well, there were probably less things coming out of these discussions than in the other ones, but I just got the answer. I know why. Everyone was going up to Don, John, and Jeff and telling them, we want to help, we want to do one. So you've done one much better than we even were hoping for, and thanks very much for that. But there were some ideas that did come up. Public information campaign, and John could be nominated to do that. He's already started here by explaining to us what the conflict is about. Making this an electoral issue, and I think we all know in this room how important that is. Engage local Muslim and Arab and Muslim countries on this issue to talk not to the detriment of the Arab-Israeli conflict, but to talk to them about something else as well. Engage the evangelical churches perhaps in an interfaith way. Support with your pocketbook companies like Timberland who are involved in this, and the flip side, divest from those who are not doing the right thing. And then the last one that came was to clone Don Cheadle. Now, that's one that I think may be even beyond CGI's capacities, but we could try.
That's already in place.
Well, that's great to hear. That's your commitment. Thank you very much.
Just this week, the president named a special envoy, Andrew Natsios, a very fine man who is here today. I saw him early this afternoon. I don't know if he's in the audience. The immediate question, or at least one immediate question, is the willingness of outside powers to send military personnel in some capacity, UN or otherwise, into Sudan over the objection of the government of Sudan. You follow this closely. That's a big thing for people outside for obvious reasons, because they fear setting precedents that may subsequently come back to haunt them. There was not a long history of external intervention to deal with internal crises. What is your answer to that? What should the United States government do?
Thanks for bringing it up.
There is a history of external.
Yeah.
Well, there is a history of external force being exerted to resolve internal conflicts, but there needs to be a boon, usually in oil or some other. I mean, am I incorrect? I mean, there is a history, but it rarely seems to work if it's a purely altruistic or humanitarian effort. And I just wanted to say that before.
Yeah, and of course, when we did try in Somalia, and at the end of 92 and 93, unfortunately, the events of October 93 and Black Hawk Down has given us the wrong sort of lesson, and then the legacy, which has lasted more than a decade, of that fateful day. But I think that I just couldn't reiterate this enough, that it's a false construct to say, do we invade or do we not invade today to protect civilians in Darfur? There are so many things we could do now to influence the government to stop killing, to allow for a protection force to go in that would be consensual, that we need to move those along as we plan and prepare, as anyone would in government, for the potential eventuality, hope we don't have to do it, of an intervention which would be against the will of the government.
But am I fair in interpreting your answer to be, therefore, that you would not favor that immediate type of external evasion, but would rather favor taking the intermediate steps while planning for that difficult step, should it become necessary at some later point in time?
Well, the way you ask it makes me sound so weak, but yes. Anyways, to put it my way, is that we are not ready to invade Sudan. We're not going to do that tomorrow. With what forces? Where are we going to stage from? Let's get practical here.
Yeah.
So we can start planning that process. We can accelerate that process of planning. But right now, that government that is committing the worst atrocities on the planet today has not had one penalty imposed, one punitive measure imposed on it for the entire 3.5 years of killing. How is their calculation about continuing that process going to be influenced unless we get serious about implementing all these words, never again, and all these wonderful UN resolutions that authorize all these actions? You hit them hard. There's a track record that they change their behavior when you hit them, and we will accelerate decisions that allow the dismantling of the Janjaweed, Sudan's KKK, that allow for the deployment of UN forces in a consensual environment. And it may be a hybrid. The government of Sudan has to have a face-saving exit out of this. It'll probably be an AU-led force that the UN then undergirds. It'll be a bit of a new model. But we can get there with some real diplomacy. So Andrew, Natsios, and others internationally are going to have to work just as you did in Northern Ireland, walk, chew gum, whistle at the same time, doing a number of things, imposing the costs while undertaking the planning for non-consensual deployment, while preparing how you undergird the current force, which in there, the African Union force, 7,000 troops, that needs to be built up very substantially with the kind of resources and manpower to make it relevant to protection of people. And strengthen the mandate so they can protect people. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what are we trying to do in Darfur? We're trying to protect people and allow them to go home. And that's going to happen in the context of a political solution. So you've got to do, as Jeffrey's saying, a number of things, and as Don is saying, that you can't just pick one little thing and say, should we invade? Because even if we threw 20,000 troops in there, it's a place the size, if you're a Republican in Texas, if you're a Democrat, of France. I mean, that's a big place. So we throw these people in there, where's the logistics supply lines, 2 or 3 casualties, and where's the political will going to be to stay there? It's crushing to me that we have so many things that we could do today if we had the political will to do them that could change the calculation of the government and have it stop the atrocities rather than having this false debate about whether we throw a military force in there, which we have no soldiers for and no logistical supply lines and no staging ground for to begin with. So we got a lot of planning to do to get there, and we may get there. Look, if the African Union forces leave, if the NGOs have to leave eventually, then we're going to have to send in troops. But we're not there yet, so we've got to accelerate that planning. But in the meantime, we can do things that can change the situation on the ground now.
You mentioned a political solution, and several people asked what it's hard to foresee, obviously, and at this time, difficult to answer with certainty, but what would the terms of a political solution be? What would a settlement be?
Well, there was a very painstaking effort over 2 years to try to come up with a peace deal. And the U.S. sent the Deputy Secretary of State in for the last 4 days of the negotiations in May 2000, right after the rally that took place in at the end of April in Washington, where 60,000-70,000 people turned up. President Bush promised the rally that he would send Bob Zelik to do the job, negotiate the solution for Darfur. So there's an infrastructure of peace deal. Unfortunately, Zelik left 4 days into the negotiations. They got one rebel group to sign, and there are still things that need to be addressed in that agreement that would bring the other groups on board. So first and foremost is having an international role in dismantling the Janjaweed. I went in twice now to the refugee camps and to rebel-held areas of Darfur since that agreement was signed. And we talked to hundreds of people, Darfurians, and not one Darfurian either supported the peace deal in its current form or said that they would go home in that environment while the Janjaweed remains intact. So we've got to, Andrew has to take the lead essentially because no one else will. Has got to take the lead in negotiating an addendum to that current agreement that allows for international participation, like in any other peace deal anywhere in the world, international participation in the DDR process, the demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration. It's very standard. We took the promise of the government of Sudan after all the violations of every oath that they had made to us directly and indirectly over the last 3 years. We took their word and walked away. And that wasn't good enough. So they've continued the killing since the peace agreement. It's got to be amended, and then once you have a real agreement, which is, again, painstaking negotiations like you know better than anyone, we go through that process. Then when you deploy force in support of an agreement that people are have some support for, we'll have a real durable solution in Darfur.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, again very much. Please join me in giving a round of applause for our panel. Really terrific.
Well, this closes our panel discussions. There's still some plenaries and special sessions tomorrow. I think I'll speak for all of us in saying that this was exhausting, exhilarating, and I hope effective. I do want to say there's some people we really have to thank, and they have not been thanked throughout these days, and without them this really couldn't have happened. It's the table facilitators, the theme team members. I really want like all of us to give them a great round of applause because they were all volunteers. We ended with this panel. It wasn't a coincidence because really I think all three of them, John, Jeff, and Don, personify what CGI is about. It's three people who could have done very well without Darfur, thank you very much. They didn't need to get involved. And they decided to get involved. They chose to get involved because they wanted to make a difference. And that is really what CGI is about. It's about people who don't have any need to do something, but who feel the need to do something nonetheless. And I think Jeff put it in a way that I really would like to use and paraphrase him from now on in terms of what CGI is about. It's about whether you want to be illogically active or missing in action. And because you're all here, I think we all know which label you chose. Thank you very much, and we'll see you all later tonight.
Table facilitators, please remain and open your laptops to your debriefing page.